There are two experiments like that, one in California and one in Minnesota. And the one in California went through.
The Stanford experiment?
Okay, they made it for 2 weeks, I think. They had a bunch of, playing guards and a bunch of playing.
They took a class like this and divided them up, half were guards and half were inmates. And they said after
the guards started oppressing me.
That's right. That's right. The students who were assigned to the role of, they saw how the roles brutalized people. You see, they saw how those who were assigned to the role of guards became brutalistic and very super authoritarian and ordering people around and just nasty and shit, you know? And the ones who were assigned to be inmates first tried to resist, and then the guards broke them up and used the isolation separation rules, you know, and the inmates got very demoralized and depressed, you know. And one guy almost flipped out at the end of 6 days, you know. And it was really, there's a film of it, you know. Somebody told me the other day there's a film of it. I want to get that.
There's
film.
Another experiment, this is kind of fascinating too, which occurred in Minnesota, where they took a group of women who were like the junior league. And they volunteered for this thing. And they put them in and they said, okay, you can't talk to one another. You can sit near each other, but you can't talk to one another. And they were supposed to be in for a week or so. And after 28 hours, all the women said, forget it, we want to end this experiment.
Really? But the thing is, you see, that when you, if you're sent there, you don't have it, you have to stand it, you see, you don't have any choice, you know. You can either stand it or hang it up, you know, there's two ways to deal with the problem, you know.
My question was,
so you find out if you get a... You could get in a county jail easily enough, you know. You can get in a county jail easily enough just by getting a ticket and refusing and not paying it, you see. And then when the court time comes, refusing to pay the fine, you know. So you could do something like that, or you could get yourself arrested for some kind of weird misdemeanor or something like that, you know. And you could get there, and just by not paying the bond, you could stay in there a week and come out whenever you wanted to, you know. But the penitentiary is a different matter, you see. You have to be sentenced there. That's a whole, you don't want to do that.
I would do it, but it has no sense, it's useless.
Yeah.
You can, well, we will show you through the terms some of these institutions if you want to walk through the general population.
Well, here, you know, women in Michigan are all sent to the Detroit House of Correction. That's the only women's prison in Michigan. And it's much worse in many ways in the men's prisons, you know.
I've heard Jane Kennedy's speaking.
Right.
And
she did 15 months.
That was so frightening, that was so terrible what she told.
She won't come back to Michigan anymore. She's in Illinois, she's not coming back to Michigan.
Yeah. You know, she'll come back to, we spoke together a couple weeks ago.
She was
yeah.
there was a, from WAX there.
Right.
You can get into Wayne County Jail, which
you can take a
far more oppressive.
You can take a tour through the Wayne County Jail very easily.
You can get in. I mean, you know, if you got a traffic ticket or something and you're awaiting trial and if it's available and you don't put it up, you'll spend your time before the Wayne County Jail.
Or you'll be sent to the House of Correction.
And that's sent, they used to send them when the Wayne County suit came up, but now most of them are going right up to Wayne County, not to Hill County. I don't know.
Yeah, well, they send them there after they've been sent. What right. They tried to do was to send them out there for pre-trial, you see. Yeah, right. That was beautiful the way they struggled to say it.
The first win in that case.
Yeah, you started talking about jailhouse lawyers. I'm interested in your knowledge of Michigan. How organized are there? How many are there?
Oh, they aren't organized at all. I mean, it's almost impossible for inmates to organize themselves in any way unless they take part in the Alcoholics Anonymous program. No, they exchange information, you know. But... I guess if you're in general population, you can use, they have a law library. I knew the law librarian pretty well, a brother named George. And he was really good. I saw some briefs that he looked up, which were really excellent, you know. And then there's other guys who, I had a very close friend who I was locked up with for a long time named Benny Lee Scott from Flint. And he didn't even know how, hardly knew how to read or write. He got 12 and a half to 15 on a manslaughter, on a felony manslaughter beef out of Flint. And he was just had the typical experience of being railroaded through and made to cop and stuff like that, and a lot of weirdness in his case. And he already knew how to write, read or write. And he taught himself, and he got into law books, and he is getting to the point now where his briefs are halfway coherent, you know. But he spends, that's all he does. You know, he spends all day, any money that he can get in any way by doing, like, he does legal work for other inmates and has their people send money to his account and things, and he uses that money to buy law books with. And just all day, you know, from 7 in the morning until 10 at night, that's all he does. Unless there's a yard period, stays in his law books, you know. So they're really dedicated. I mean, I know quite a few of them, you know, who are really, and the ones that there are well known. So if you're in touch with three or four of them, you can be in touch with all of them, probably. But you'd have to be in touch with them more or less individually. Oh, yeah. To be a jailhouse lawyer, you have to first apply to the warden or the deputy warden. You know the Johnson versus Avery case? That's the Bible, you see. Benny Lee Scott carries the Johnson versus Avery decision around as his Bible, you know. So when they hassle him for, when a guard hassles him for anything, he hands him the decision, you know. And says, look, you know. And they try, but he consistently is faced with them trying to take his typewriter away or trying to take his law books away. Or they come in his cell and he's got cases in there involving inmates that he hasn't registered with the thing, you know, and they take them away from him and he has to go through a million changes to get them back. They just make it difficult, you know. Anybody who's trying to do anything, they make it as difficult as they possibly can for that person to do anything. See, that's the whole, you know, and again, inmates are powerless, you know, and for the most part have no support from the outside, and they just struggle, you know, independently on their own.
But they can register with the warden.
Evidently. Right. Right.
Once
that's done, well, then I'm not sure how it works, but maybe each inmate who wants to work with this person has to go to the warden.
One other
Oh, yeah? Oh, great. I could put you in touch with some people, you know, and you could write to, but it may never get there. That'd be wonderful. That'd certainly be possible from our end, yeah.
I think it'd be possible.
Let me get some of these questions and then we'll...
Okay, go ahead. I want to make one statement because I think I don't want to impose upon the class a political sense. But what I do think is the person like even entitling the class rather than making it, you know, like just correction law or something like that, made it similar to creditors' rights, prisoners' rights.
Right.
So I think that's really where we're going.
Right. Well, that's our committee, it's the Mission Committee for Prisoners' Rights, you see. And it's not a political organization, you know. I mean, it's a broad-based organization. No, it'll have state senators and representatives and doctors and, you know, and all kinds of people like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Guys,
they had, I don't know about Marquette. You know, I never had a hearing of any kind of Marquette, so I don't really know from my own experience what their procedure is, but I imagine it's essentially the same as Jackson, which is where they have a disciplinary board made up of one of the deputy wardens or the warden or the inspector and someone from the treatment office and someone from the counselor's staff. Those are the three officers on the hearing board. And you're taken before and you're charged and they find you guilty or not guilty, you know, and decide what they'll do to you. You have no, and the federal courts are unanimous in denying the right to prisoners to have legal representation. To this point, am I not correct? That was the state a couple months ago.
The representation is not the problem. The impartial trier of fact is the real problem.
Yeah.
So far, what they've done is said that they can use one of the corrections officers to try the case. And so it's like, you know, one him, one
right,
the other.
Right.
As far as lawyers are concerned, like they've left lawyers in for removal hearing and all that lawyers and some of the disciplinary stuff. But it doesn't matter because I mean you try it before the guy's
present. Yeah. Yeah, right. Certainly. Misleading statements, yeah.
How does an inmate avoid, or how can outside people help an inmate under these kinds of conditions?
Well, generally, if there is relief, it would come as a result of organized support by an organization that's committed to supporting inmates. Of everybody in the whole Michigan prison system, you know, outside of people like Billy Giacalone and people who have a lot of money, I had probably the most advantages of anybody in there, you know, because of my, affiliation with a political party and people working full time trying to get me out and offering support and many attorneys and people, the media and stuff like that. So I have more of that than anybody, and I was locked up for the 15 months, you know. I mean, I was kept segregated for 15 months, and there just wasn't anything that could be done about that, you know. And so there's going to be some of that, you see.
Would you try? I mean, did anybody attempt to get you back into general population?
Well, I carried on a struggle for 12 of those 15 months.
We
brought suit in the federal court on December 17th, 1970.
Remember the judges, he denied all jurisdiction except for the question of one thing.
Well, First Amendment rights, you know. But I mean, that's the first suit in 17 years that has been entertained by the federal courts. You see? That's how we got this stuff here. You know, that's how we got my prison record. The judge ordered them to let us copy the record.
Well,
So we went farther than has ever been gone before, you know, with this one court. And I was really hoping that, of course, I'm glad David got out of the lockup, you know. But
right now, I'm not sure if David is. That's what we got to ask.
Yeah, right, right. I wasn't sure at first either. You know?
We didn't get him out. I mean, all we did was bring the suit.
Right, well, that's what does it. I mean, I was in 5 West 000, you know. I was in the hole, and they had told me a week previously that I was going to stay there. You know, I was going to stay there until they could send me up to Marquette again. And I had a court order at the time restraining them from sending me to Marquette, say a federal court order, solely because I had another case, you know, in federal court. So, I mean, that's what they did to me, you know, and there wasn't very much that could be done about that, you know. So, but inmates, I mean, see, this is the thing. What's beautiful about what's going on is that a lot of inmates are developing a very high political consciousness, a very high degree of political consciousness, where they realize that it isn't about individualism, you know? So they don't care. I mean, they're locked up anyway, you know? I mean, being locked up to them is an honor, you know, to a lot of inmates who are struggling in the penitentiary. Being locked up is an honor because it's the way that they have of seeing that they're doing something useful, you know? Because if they're doing something useful, they're going to be locked up. See? So they don't mind being locked up if there's a struggle going on in support of what they're locked up for. You know, like I never, you know, I mean, I hated being locked up. You know, but on the other hand, I wouldn't, if it came down to a choice of being locked up or giving up the struggle, it was always a question of staying locked up because, you know, as long as there was something going on and people trying to do something about it, then it isn't that big a thing. See, and a lot of inmates are developing this consciousness, which is really the important part. So, like the sister was saying over here, it isn't so bad being locked up if you got people trying to do something about the conditions that you're fighting against, you know, which fight caused you to be locked up in the first place, you see. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can always go straight, you know. I mean, if it gets worse, that's another thing that always works, you see, is that you can always just stop that and shuffle and, you know, shuck and jive, you see. And they want to believe so badly that they've broken you, you see, that you can convince them of that very easily. You know? They want to hear it so bad, you see. Massa, I'm tired of fighting, I'm going to toe the line and you let me go, see? And they'll make deals like that with you, you know.
We've never done anything about sense determination. We've never done anything about the power.
Oh, boy, that is real. I was just talking to Kenny Cockrell about that this afternoon, you know, about that whole revision of the criminal code. And that's just, if that goes through without a concomitant complete restructuring, of the whole parole board system and the whole parole system, it's a setback. You have the situation where they can do what they did to George Jackson, for example. You know, 1 year to life or 5 to life, whatever, and they can just flop you every year. Every 12 months they flop you, you know. So you do 10 years on a $70 robbery, you know. And there's no recourse, you see, because what is the California Adult Authority composed of? It's composed of FBI officials, ex-FBI officers, ex-police officers, and ex-corrections department officers. You know, the worst scum in society, you see, is running these boards, you know. Oh, man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Jimmy Hoffman's made several verbal
just
to
right. Not that I know of. I know he's alive with some kind of weird organization in Detroit which involves Jerome Kavanaugh and people like this who are now, yeah, Geraldine Bledsoe Ford, who's known for giving people 1 million days, you know. These are people who are all of a sudden very concerned about the Wayne County Jail, and they're going to form this committee and office on that. Our problem is, you see, that we're just in the process of organizing this committee, you know. I just got out of the penitentiary, and the other person who's involved with it also just got out of the penitentiary. And we're involved in reorienting ourselves to what's going on out here, you know. So it's progressing slower than it would normally if just some people were organizing it, you know. So that is to say that, I don't know, maybe his intentions would be to support this. I intend to get in touch with him, hopefully, you know.
With your desire to aid the prisoners, would you actively
support this? Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, when we have something that's more together than it is now, we want to approach him, you know, and see what he's into. I mean, he just got the $1,200,000 pension settlement for his efforts in behalf of the workers, you know. And that's a lot of bread. Right, 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 exactly. And he's probably sincere. He did 5 years, you know, in the penitentiary, man. But still in all, I mean, he was in that cell every day, you see. He was in that mattress factory every day. You can't escape being affected by something like that, you know? Well, there's type material, you know. Part of what my suit directly involves is the ideology of the Black Panther Party, which I typed up for some brothers who had a copy. I typed them copies. And they were using it as an organizational tool. They also had, in Marquette, we had red books, and we had a complete, in Marquette, you see, Marquette is a weird place, you know, because on the one hand, it's the most oppressive thing, and on the other hand, it's also the most lenient, or was when I was there, the most lenient, because it's small. It's like 583 inmates inside the walls. And it's small and it's very close, and they can watch everything. And besides, it's so far away that they have to do something to compensate, you see, for putting you up there. You know, otherwise it'd just be a continuous rebellion. You know, so the visits, people who can come up there, the visits are just incredible. You know, you can visit for 4 or 5 days in a row, all day. See, people can come and see it all day, 4 or 5 days in a row, and that's great. And as far as the literature was concerned, they probably clamped down on it now because of their bad experience, you know. But we had a people's library that was much more popular than the prison library, you know. We had a complete, a large revolutionary library of selected works of Mao Zedong, works of Lenin, Marx, Engels, Kwame Nkrumah, Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, Kim Il-sung, Ho Chi Minh, General Giap, et cetera, et cetera. And plus all black literature of all kinds, Seize the Time, books like that. Couldn't get the Black Panther newspaper in there, but we had evolved, by the time I got run out of there, we had evolved ways of getting papers sent in. Sent to dudes who had no thing, you know, who were Casper Milquetoast inmates, you know. And so they would receive newspapers that were rolled up and they wouldn't ever open them, you know, and there would be copies of the Black Panther and things like that.
Other than
honesty,
maybe the ideology of the Black Panther Party.
No, the Black Panther Party. Nothing. Chronicle is allowed. Jet. Ebony, you know, the general public. I mean, that, you know, they used to didn't have stuff like that. You see. Certain books can be ordered from Vaughn's bookstore. You know, Vaughn's catalogs are allowed. And certain books can be ordered from there. You know, although they cut now more and more. You see.
And Jackson, the Red Book is illegal.
Yeah, really. Yeah, contraband. The quotations from Chairman Mao Zedong.
Is there any kind of drug
They have something in a psychiatric clinic at Jackson, which I was just beginning to find out about before I left. Other than that, they have Narcotics Anonymous, you know, which is the thing that you go to once a week so that when you go to the parole board, you can say, I went to Narcotics Anonymous and attempted to grapple with my narcotics problem for a period of so many months. You say, please give me a parole. You know, that's what the narcotics treatment problem is about, you know, period. I believe so. I understand that they do, yeah. Although they're constantly taking stricter and stricter measures to stop it.
Written charges against people, subsequent criminal charges, things like possession, assault,
stabbing somebody, yeah. Rape,
now,
a lot of rapes.
Would they normally sentence you twice for that? In other words, first of all, put you into a lockup, and then say, okay,
yes.
Now we're bringing the charge?
Yes, definitely.
The psychotherapist is speaking to you, if prisoners want to have a psychotherapist, can they?
Independent? I mean, someone from outside?
Yes, or is there, is not?
They have a psychiatric clinic at Jackson, which serves the entire Michigan Department of Corrections. Interestingly enough, the director of the psychiatric clinic was the most human person I met in the whole system, he and his assistant, or his administrative aide. His name is Dr. Fred Pasetsky, who's the director of the psychiatric clinic. He's like a white liberal. The administration doesn't relate to him very well. There's a real contradiction between his area and the general administration. They hate him. You see, he makes it difficult for custody. You know, but, and again, I'm not saying to say, I mean, the psychiatric clinic is probably a snake pit, you know. But I just know from, I mean, you can't really be let yourself be fooled by the niceness of particular individuals who represent this system, you see, because they're real nice and everything, but then they just sign the papers and somebody else carries out the dirty stuff, you see, so you never know what they're up to. What are the possibilities? I think the possibilities are good. We're involved in trying to get that together now. And hopefully within the next month, you know, the structure and the way that will work will appear. We're interested in later on, as this develops, publishing like a monthly newspaper for inmates, you see, which would be mostly like a bulletin board, you know. So inmates who are, so people can keep in touch with each other and also to present information as to what's happening to various individuals, you see, and to coordinate this stuff and also to let prisoners know what their legal rights are and what recourse is available to them and what attorneys or law students or whatever, what's going on. They can. Now to do this, you see, this involves a whole legal attack because in order to do this, we're going to have a legal struggle on two fronts. One, for the inmates to be able to write, have unrestricted access to the Michigan Committee for Prisoners' Rights, and two, for the newspaper, once the inmates' contributions are made, to be allowed to get back into the inmates, you know. And again, I didn't mean to really be so negativistic, you know, about the pamphlet you were talking about, you know. But again, with this, you know, the objective would be, as with the pamphlet, to get mass distribution inside the penitentiary. And that's a goal that may or may not be realizable, you know. You know it can be done because the Muslims did it with their paper, you see. So you know if you do it right, you know, over a period of time, that you can accomplish that goal. But it isn't going to be easy, you know. It's going to be a struggle because the main thing about the penitentiary is information control, you see. They don't want inmates finding out what can help them, and they don't want people on the outside finding out what's going on with inmates, you see. They run those as fiefs. You know, a penitentiary is like the warden's fiefdom, you see.
And it really brings this kind of full circle, because I agree, I've thought about that. I think that the chances are, though, that by saying to a court, hey, like, we're bringing in the law, man.
Right.
I mean, this is
right. I mean, there's ways it can be structured where, you know, not just in the court, but also as a whole publicity thing done on it, you know, create a scandal, you see. And so, just front them off, you know, it can be done, but it's going to take a struggle, you know. I mean, I don't even talk in terms of people say, well, a prisoner's newsletter, or we'll just get a prisoner present. It's a struggle, you know. It's a struggle. They don't want it in there, you see. One of the other things we're going to be involved in, hopefully, is mounting an attack under the slogan, open up the prisons, you know, to allow people, citizens, to go in and take tours, to allow attorneys to have access to prisoners in their cells to see what it is that they're like, to represent, you know, also to let the news media talk to inmates. That's one of the biggest things right there, you see. Let the news media in there. You know, we got a lot of people on the news media who would do stuff. You know, there was a lot of people who wanted to come in and interview me, and it was just forbidden. You see, they just wouldn't let it happen. You know, now with an organization involved, we can get someone and get some reporters from prestigious publications and have them apply to see this person and have them be refused and then mount, take them into court, you see, and mount an attack.
Mr. Ransford, tell us what this means, what this Supreme Court decision means in real life terms.
What it means is that, what it means is that reporters have always operated on the assumption that they have a privilege to refuse to reveal their sources to a grand jury. In a number of states, I think it's 17, they actually have statutes which enable reporters in certain instances to refuse to reveal their sources. In the other states, reporters have always just assumed it. Now, because of the Supreme Court decision, reporters can no longer tell sources, yes, I can refuse to reveal your name if I'm called before a grand jury. And that isn't good enough for sources. If I'm interviewing somebody about drugs, he can't be given a maybe. He has to be given an absolute flat guarantee that his name will not be revealed. Otherwise, he's not going to agree to cooperate with me for purposes of doing a story. And so, what it comes down to now is I have to convince a source that I'm willing to go to jail to him. And for a lot of sources, that's not enough. I had a junkie tell me he was sort of a middle-level dope dealer, tell me that he believed I would go to jail for him rather than give his name away. But he said that when I got into the jail here in Wayne County, I would be raped, I would be beaten. And he said, and how long will you be able to take the raping and the beating? He says, I don't think you're going to be able to take it that long. He says, and then you might want to give me away. He says, I'll know if you're breaking it when you're in jail. And if I hear you are breaking, I'd have you killed before you got out of jail. And in those kinds of circumstances, people just don't cooperate with reporters. That man refused to cooperate with me because of the Supreme Court decision. And there have been other cases.
You feel it limits the knowledge that the people, the public, can give from reporters. It limits the amount of reporting you can do, the quality of reporting. And the fact is, the first step in controlling the media and controlling the information that goes into the media, in actuality, is the first step towards the 1984, quote unquote.
If that were governmental design to control the media, that would be a major first step. I don't know if it is or not, but it has that effect. And anyhow, The kind of people who want to give information but cannot reveal their names are also the kind of people who could be critical of the government. They're usually people who have contact with the problem themselves, like Daniel Ellsberg knowing about the Pentagon Papers. He asked for confidentiality originally. If he hadn't been given that original promise, he probably wouldn't have revealed those papers. Of course, the whole thing was blown later by Sidney Zion, but But it's stories like that that can only be done through confidential sources.
What happens to a guy like Jack Anderson?
Well, I don't know what happens to him. Jack Anderson has said that he'll continue to use confidential sources, even if it means he has to write his stories from a jail cell. He depends entirely on them. He's usually getting his information from government officials, people whose whole careers would be compromised if he revealed them. It wouldn't surprise me if ultimately Jack Anderson ends up in jail himself, but the problem is his name is so big, he is so famous, and if anyone tried to subpoena him, it would become a really big cause celeb. Whereas most of the reporters that have been subpoenaed so far are not big, famous names. Any fame they've gotten, they have, is because of their cases. Earl Caldwell wasn't a famous personality or wasn't famous before all this. I'm certainly not. Others aren't. I think it'd be more dangerous in his case to subpoena him.
Are you saying that it will be or has been selectively enforced against people who the government feels it can squash without outraging the public?
Well, I don't know if I can really say that. I mean, the government has had the balls to go against the New York Times, and when it would be easier to pick on a small little weekly paper out in Tennessee or something. So maybe it isn't all that selective. And after all, there was a clash of the United States government with the Los Angeles Times recently. So perhaps it isn't all that selective. I haven't really thought about it in those terms, you know, how the government orchestrates it. I just think about it from a reporter's point of view. And you're asking me to speculate about how the government thinks. I don't know.
Talk about what the role of the Justice Department has been in all of this.
Well, in my particular case, I had no contact with them because mine was just a Kentucky case. But the Justice Department asked Earl Caldwell to cooperate with them and give him all information he had about Black Panthers. He was a reporter working out of the San Francisco Bureau, doing a lot of stories about Panthers. He kept getting repeated calls day after day from FBI agents. And finally, he refused to take calls from them and had a secretary pick up the phone. He was harassed. Finally, he was subpoenaed. Ultimately, the Justice Department formulated a series of guidelines for requests for information from reporters, and that's been basically the interaction with Earl Caldwell.
There haven't been that many federal cases.
There's a follow-up on television, now part of that same thing.
Terms of the confidentiality the reporters had, whether it was written or unwritten.
Okay, well, in about 17 states, they had a privilege. Usually it was a qualified privilege as opposed to an absolute one. An absolute one means the reporter can, in all cases, refuse to testify. In Kentucky, there was a qualified privilege statute. In my case, it really applied to me, but the Kentucky Court of Appeals just ruled it right out of existence in my case. But in the other states, it was just widely assumed by reporters that they had a privilege in the First Amendment. Now it's gone. And a really basic issue now is whether there should be an absolute privilege statute or a qualified privilege statute. There are both before Congress right now. And it seems very clear to me that it has to be absolute for the point I mentioned before, for the reason I mentioned before, that when you talk to a source, you can't say, maybe your name will not be revealed, maybe it will. You have to be able to say, it cannot be revealed, I will not reveal it. And unless you have an absolute privilege statute, sources just won't cooperate. It'll just be on the basis of a judgment, will he go to jail for me? And few people can make that kind of a decision.
All right, let me ask you this. If the public has a right to know a certain kind of information, doesn't it also have the right to know the source of that information?
I think that it's a simplistic question. It's always better. It's always better if the public can know who the source is. But sometimes a story is impossible without the source. And if the story will not ever get into the paper unless you guarantee a source confidentiality, then the reporter has to make a compromise. If If Neil Sheen of the New York Times hadn't made that promise of confidentiality, Ellsberg wouldn't have given him the Pentagon Papers, and the American public would have suffered.
All right, let me ask you this. The issue that we're talking about here, is it limited to repression of the press or repression of the media, or is it? Are we really talking about repression of the people?
There's no question. It's really ultimately repression of well, it's just cutting off the public's information, which ultimately is repression of people. Recently, for example, I had the opportunity to do a really unique story. I don't think it's ever been done before by any journalist in this country, but it definitely would have involved the possibility of a subpoena before a grand jury. And I went to the to my editors at the Free Press and I proposed the story. And they agreed that it was a fine story. But they said, well, it involves a subpoena. And that means thousands of dollars in legal expenses and possibility of jail. And so naturally we have to pick our stories. We have to pick one where we really think it's worth that kind of a fight. And they decided that the particular story I had in mind was perhaps wasn't worth the trouble that it would entail. So what happens is you get a penumbra of stories where the editors don't think it's worthwhile to do this particular story because it isn't important enough. And that means in those areas, people just aren't going to find out. It's the people who suffer. It isn't really a few reporters who go to jail. You know, in all fairness to the editors, though, another one of their considerations was that Governor Milliken is now considering my extradition. And they figured that it wouldn't be very cool right now for me to end up in jail in Michigan while he's considering whether or not to extradite me to Kentucky. So that was another one of their considerations.
Hope you put that wet.
Wait a minute. Okay. We're talking about selectivity of repression in various cases. We're talking about your case in Louisville. We're talking about cases in California. We're talking about various cases. What is the basis of the selectivity of the repression? Is it a total repressive selection against the people, totally repressive selection against various forms of people's activities, or is it selection against specific newspapers, against specific individuals for specific things that they do?
It's hard to see an overall pattern. In the case of Earl Caldwell, what the federal government was after was information about Black Panthers. That was the overriding concern. They wanted to get the Panthers, and Caldwell had a lot of information about them. So it was selective in the sense that the government was after Panthers. In my case, I think what was really happening was that there was a very conservative, reactionary prosecutor against a liberal newspaper in a conservative state. And it's good politics in Kentucky to denounce the Louisville Courier-Journal, the paper I worked for. And this was a splendid opportunity for the prosecutor to embarrass the newspaper. I can't prove that was his motivation, but I suspect that that's what was happening. And so it had nothing to do, in his case, with the press. It was just a way for him to embarrass a local newspaper.
Would it have anything to do at all with the type of investigation you did, as to the content of it, such as the dope?
You know, I think there was an element of that. I had done a lot of reporting about drugs. Before I'd gotten into trouble, I did a newspaper series, eight pages long, about drugs, and it was all based on confidential sources. We even had pictures of people shooting up heroin. It was everything. But because part of that series was based on how the narcs worked, and I rode around the narcs and watched them bust people and everything, there was like no sense that it was the newspaper versus the establishment. But then as soon as I went out and did a little story about guys producing hash, and we put it on the front page, and we have pictures, and we start putting crimes on the front page, and the criminals are giving their stories, it becomes a challenge to everybody. Because if one thing, it makes the police look stupid. That wasn't my intention, but it has that effect. Here are criminals are granting interviews to the press, and they're allowing reporters to take pictures of them in operation. And I guess that they had to react. They had to show that they have muscle, that this is not going to happen. And by knocking down this one reporter who had the nerve to do that, it probably put fear into the hearts of other reporters who might consider doing that. I don't know.
You speculate on the differentiation between, as you just now said, that you did a long investigation into hard drugs, which you implied by heroin, showing heroin shooters and stuff. The Detroit Free Press did a long investigation against hard drugs in Detroit, which hasn't had a subpoena against yet. But the minute someone does an investigative reporting on something like hashish, which has been found to be proven not detrimental to society, in fact, helps promote growth in society, or something like the Black Panthers, which work in the community to better people's living conditions, is there any sort of correlation between that kind of selectiveness?
I don't know, yeah, because if you look at all the cases, it's hard to draw a pattern. In the Bill Farr case out in Los Angeles, he was subpoenaed because somebody, perhaps a lawyer, had given him information about the testimony of one of the witnesses in the Charlie Manson case. And can you find some kind of political motivation behind subpoenaing Bill Farr in that case? I can't. It's hard to draw a pattern.
Can you?
No. What the hell is it for then?
Just we're on the air. We're on the
okay.
air.
Okay.
All right. Can you speculate on why the public hasn't gotten more upset, more outraged about this?
I don't really think the public understands it all that clearly. There's been a Gallup poll that shows that the majority of them are behind reporters, but I don't know. I think the reporting, the understanding, nevertheless, is limited. One of the problems is that the American press has not really been doing its job. They haven't been doing enough investigative reporting. They haven't been doing the kind of things that, for example, Ralph Nader does, the kind of going out there and digging into General Motors until they find out what's going on and then publishing it. Instead, they could run to press conferences in Washington, D.C. and cover what Ralph Nader says tells them instead of going out and doing it themselves. And it's because they haven't been doing that as much as they should have been that I think that judges and many people in the public don't understand what journalism could be, what it ought to be. And so there's less understanding of why the press needs privileged statutes. Does that answer it? We're sitting in the Supreme Court of the United States and watching the justices ask questions of my lawyer, and you could see in their faces that a lot of them really did not believe that reporters needed a privilege statute. And I had a feeling that what was going through their minds is, I haven't seen that much in the stuff in the paper, based on confidential sources. They really did me any good. And perhaps they really haven't. And it's because the reporters haven't been doing their job. And perhaps the trouble we're going to have now getting a privilege statute is just a question of the chickens coming home to roost.
All right. Considering the level of American journalism and the straight media today, how can I, as a progressive person working in the movement, really get concerned about you?
Well, I agree. The majority of American newspapers are not doing the job they should do. They're not doing the kind of probing, digging, investigative journalism they should be doing. But the answer to that is twofold. There are some papers that do it, and there are some papers that occasionally do it, once in a while, on some little local issue. And furthermore, there's the possibility that journalism will get better rather than worse. I think there is a trend towards a more responsible type of journalism. I think journalists are better than they were years ago. And a decision like this, if it cuts off reporters from doing the kind of investigative reporting they should be doing, just cuts off the possibility of improvement of American journalism. I think that's the salvation of journalism, investigative reporting.
So what you're saying is that the Supreme Court decision tends to encourage the kind of journalism, the bad kind of journalism, the inferior kind of journalism that the media has practiced in the past.
Yeah, what is typical reporting in a newspaper? If typical coverage of City Hall or of a police department, for example, is done by a beat reporter. There are advantages to that and disadvantages. The advantage is that one guy really gets to know City Hall or really gets to know the police department. But the disadvantage is that he has to deal with the same sources every day. And if he does the kind of probing reporting that he really should, really putting it to them, really embarrassing the hell out of them, he's dried up all of his sources and will not be able to continue doing it. He has an investment in getting along with his sources. So therefore, that tends to discourage really hard-hitting reporting.
Do newspapers, straight newspapers, really know what's going on?
I think there are papers in this country that don't know their way around the corner, frankly. I think they know what the politicians tell them at City Hall. They know what the cops tell them down at the police headquarters. But often they don't even know if they're being lied to or not. They faithfully and accurately transcribe what is being told them. But what is being told them can often be an outright lie. And I think the newspapers are also selective about who they decide to trust and who they mistrust. If a policeman tells them something about how so-and-so did this out in the street, well, he has to be respected. He is a policeman. But if the criminal tells them what the policeman was doing, well, no. I mean, he's been labeled as a criminal. We can't believe him. I don't think it's all so clear out in the streets. I don't think it's so clear that you can believe politicians either. It certainly isn't so clear to me that they should report President Nixon's news conferences as if he's everything he says is the gospel, the unvarnished truth. There just isn't enough checking, in-depth reporting to find out what the truth is rather than just what certain selected officials are saying is the truth. Reporting in this country is lazy.
So now with the Supreme Court decision, publishers have a built-in cop-out, and they don't have to pursue the kind of things that you were pursuing.
Well, I don't know if it's a cop-out. I think there are some publishers that will try to do hard-hitting reporting. I mean, the Washington Post is trying to do its best in the Watergate case. But I think there are a lot of publishers who might want an excuse to continue mediocre journalism. And when a reporter comes to them and says, we want to do this story, but it's going to mean a subpoena, they'll say, no, I don't believe in having reporters in prison. Let's not do that. And he has a reason now, a reason to cover up what is basically either a lack of knowledge of what good reporting is or just basic cowardice.
Or fascism.
No, wait a minute. I didn't say that. That was Howard Cohn, rabble rouser. One of the really amazing things about newspapers is that they profess objectivity, but they really aren't. They're only objective within a very limited framework. They see things from a middle class point of view, generally from a white point of view, generally from, let's believe everything big government officials tell us until we're given proof otherwise point of view. And the way this comes about isn't by conscious design. I don't think top editors sit down every day and they say, well, what's the propaganda line going to be this year? What it is that because of their whole background, they tend to pick certain kinds of people as reporters, people who tend to think the way they do. A reporter who doesn't think a certain way may not get a job as easily. I once had an interview with the Washington Post, and I suggested to the Washington Post during that interview that the press had failed in its reporting of the Warren Commission, the Kennedy assassination, that there was more to that killing than they had gotten into. And instead, they just reported that Warren Commission report as the gospel truth without sending teams of reporters down to Dallas to try to find out what really happened down there. Well, I think I came off as a hothead with the editor of the Washington Post because I had that attitude. I wasn't offered the job I wanted at the Washington Post. I think there's a sort of a screening out function of people who don't tend to think the same way. Another problem is that there's sort of an unconscious screening out function with editors. They're gatekeepers of information. A reporter hands in a story challenging certain preconceptions that the editor has. The editor says, well, I don't believe this. So he tends to X certain things out of a story or kill a story entirely. He genuinely really does not believe it. Instead of, and so it's hard to get really different points of view past editors. You look at the kind of reporting you get in most newspapers about drugs, for example. The notions the public has about drugs are just mostly for the complete crock of shit. And they get a lot of their information from newspapers. But it's because editors have been reading newspapers, and they have bought the crock of shit, and reporters often have to turn the very same kind of stuff, because otherwise the editors won't believe it. And so it's a very slow process of everybody turning around and re-educating the public.